This Week in Microbiology is brought to you by the American Society for Microbiology at microbeworld.org/TWIM. This Week in Microbiology, episode number 69, recorded November 21st, 2013. Hi, everybody. I'm Vincent Racaniello, and you are listening to TWIM, the podcast that explores unseen life on Earth. Joining me today from Small Things Considered is Elio Schechter.
Well, how are you doing? Nice to have you back on our shores. I know you were in Germany for a while.
I was in Germany, and then the week before I was in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay.
Were there a lot of people who know you, Elio?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I hope they didn't tell the truth.
You're well-known everywhere. In Germany, I was at a meeting on giant DNA viruses.
Sounds scary.
Can you imagine that there is a virus with a 2.5 million base pair genome, and you can see the particles in the light microscope?
I got an email, well, the blog got a comment from Jean-Marie Clavery, who's one of the people involved in this.
He was at the meeting,
He was at the meeting, and he points out that the lack of knowledge of these things is directly due to the fact that viruses were supposed to be filterable. That's what Ivanovsky discovered in 1897 or so, 1892. And therefore, if something is not filterable, it cannot be a virus. These guys, of course, are much too big to get through a filter.
That's right.
So it's a very nice example of where a dogma is in the way of the truth.
That is absolutely right. And in fact, I did a podcast with Jean-Michel Clavery while I was there. And that'll be out on TWIV. And he talked about that, because I asked him, why are we only learning about these? And that was one reason. And the other is that, you know, we've had, you know, we've looked at viruses in terms of making disease a lot. So that kind of biases, and environmental virology has not really gotten a lot of attention. Also joining us today from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Michelle Swanson.
Hello, everyone.
How are you doing?
Great.
How's your handicap?
You know, golf season is just about come to a close here in Michigan.
Yeah.
I'm sad to say.
And you don't play all winter.
It's totally dependent on the temperature.
Yeah.
So well, you could, I'll keep you posted.
If you went somewhere warm, you could bring your clubs, right?
Oh, of course. Of course.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks for asking.
You never actually mentioned your handicap on TWIM. You will not reveal it to us, right?
It's like low 20s.
Low 20s. It's like asking your age.
Yeah.
That's what you said once.
That's right.
Also joining us today from Yale University is Joe Handelsman. Welcome back, Joe.
Thank you. Hi, everybody.
So nice to have you back, Joe.
I know you're very busy and therefore have not been able to join us, but whenever you can, it's great.
Well, thanks.
Today we have a couple of papers to do for your listening pleasure, as always. And the first one is in an interesting journal, which I generally don't read, but I do scan the table of contents. It's PLOS Computational Biology. Any of you ever scan this journal?
Do not.
No. Well, this paper is called Bacteria Human Somatic Cell Lateral Gene Transfer is Enriched in Cancer Samples, and that caught my eye. And it is by Riley, Sieber, Robinson, White, Ganesan, Nurbakhsh, and Hotop. And it is an entirely in silico analysis, which I suppose is why it's in PLOS Computational Biology. And I think it really illustrates the power of bioinformatics, as well as some of the limitations. And so what the idea is here is they were looking for the presence of bacterial DNA in human DNA. As you know, we have lots and lots of data from sequencing human genomes, and they ask whether you could get lateral gene transfer of bacterial DNA into human DNA. And we know that under certain conditions, this can happen. And it's an interesting question because, as everyone knows, we have lots of bacteria in and on us, our microbiome. Is that the right word, Elio? Can I call it a microbiome?
Yeah, I just don't know how to define it yet, but we're working on it.
Oh, you
we know, it's just other people don't.
Apparently.
Yeah, I see.
And so the likelihood is that we, our cells, take up some of this DNA, and whether it gets integrated or not into us is a good question.
Actually, if I may, yeah. they make the, I think, the very good point that proximity counts.
Mm.
And that the transfer is more likely to happen when we are next, when our cells are next to bacteria. And of course, that's the case in our body.
Right.
So it's not just the DNA floating around in the ocean and we drink it occasionally or something like that. It's that we are very near the source of the genetic information.
Yeah, that's right. So we have plenty of microbes right next to our cells. All throughout our body. So can that DNA get in there? And they cite a couple of interesting examples of known cases where bacterial DNA can get into other cells. And I guess a good one is the bacterium Agrobacterium tumefaciens, which puts its DNA into plant cells to induce a tumor, and a couple of other examples as well. And of course, you can put bacterial DNA into eukaryotic cells experimentally as well. So they set out to ask, can we find bacterial DNA in the human genome? And one of their ideas is that maybe if it does integrate, it's mutagenic, right? Because we know that viruses for sure integrate, some viruses integrate their genomes into our genomes. Retroviruses, of course, integrate, and the human papillomaviruses, when they're associated with human cancers, there's typically a piece of the papillomavirus genome integrated into our host cell, and that transforms the cells, hepatitis B viruses and others. So these are examples where the integration of viral DNA into our genome is oncogenic. So the question is, can bacterial DNA have the same effect? So there is a lot of sequence information available online from a number of different projects where the human genome has been sequenced, and they initially look at a couple of them. And this paper is interesting because, as you'll see at the end, a big problem is figuring out whether, if you find bacterial DNA in human genome sequences, whether it's real or it's an artifact, because sequencing is so sensitive, but it's also fraught with various problems that just finding bacterial DNA by itself is not enough to be conclusive. So they developed an algorithm where they could scan sequences and then pull out, say, bacterial sequences. And they validate this program with Wolbachia, which have endosymbionts, and they can find evidence of these endosymbionts in the chromosomal DNA. So they feel that the system is validated. So then they use their programs. And there are lots of...
You want to say the Wolbachia? Excuse me, Wolbachia is the endosymbiont.
Wolbachia is the endosymbiont of insects. Yes. Correct?
Yep.
So they can find Wolbachia DNA in the insect hosts, and these sequences are out there. So they can apply their algorithms to that data, and it works. They can see the Wolbachia sequence in the insect genome. So they used... now, it's interesting that when you generate sequences of humans, you can either get blood from people, and typically you take the lymphocytes and purify DNA and you sequence that. Often you get sperm. You can get sperm if you want to look for somatic integration. I'm sorry, genomes integrated into germ cells. Or you could have a cell line made from a person. In many of these genome projects where they're sequencing a lot of people's genomes, they make a cell line from you. They take some cells from your cheek and they put them in culture and they immortalize them, and then they can always go back to them. And so every project has a different kind of source of DNA. And as you'll see, that could be a problem, because if you take blood cells from a person and you make DNA, that's it. You can't go back and get more. So the sample is destroyed in the sequencing. Whereas in a cell line, you always can go back and get more of the DNA, but that can be fraught with contamination issues, because as soon as you're growing cells in a laboratory, it could be contaminated with all kinds of other DNA that you have around. All right, so they use their algorithm, and the first set of data they do, they look at, are some older sequences of the human genome, which were made by Sanger sequencing. And the reason I say Sanger sequencing is because Sanger just died recently. It was maybe yesterday or the day before. And Frederick Sanger had two Nobel Prizes, one for developing protein sequencing and one for developing DNA sequencing.
Anyway, impressive.
Right? And not apparently he was 90-something years old and was still working in the laboratory. Working.
Wow. Bless his heart.
Working on his third Nobel Prize. So the early human genome sequences were basically you take human DNA from blood or sperm or cells, whatever, and you clone it into a bacterial plasmid, and then you sequence each plasmid. All right, so this involves cloning. And by looking through those sequences, they found they have 113 million individual Sanger sequence traces. This is from 13 sequencing centers and over 8 individuals. And then they ask, they had 2,241 bacterial genomes, and they say, are there any of those bacterial genomes in the human sequences? And they found 680 sequence traces. Again, these are human sequences that contain bacterial sequences in them. And most of them were species of Lactobacillus. Okay. Now, they also found E. coli and Erythrobacter, but they throw those out because they feel that's contamination. E. coli, of course, because everybody has E. coli in their lab. And if you're cloning the human DNA for this sequencing project, it's likely that you got E. coli DNA in there as well. And they also feel that the Erythrobacter is contamination as well. So that leaves us with Lactobacillus, which I suppose makes sense, right? Because we have Lactobacilli in I, right?
Yeah, we do. And I think almost all mammals have some sort of Lactobacillus species.
Right. So that's the Sanger sequence, the cloning. So they feel that this is suggestive, but because there are so many problems with sequencing clone material, they're going to kind of put that aside. And so then they go on to the next sequence project, which is called the 1,000 Genomes Project. There is an ongoing project to sequence 1,000 human genomes, and this uses next-generation sequencing. And here, you don't have to clone the human DNA. You fragment it, you add linkers to the ends of the DNA, and then it can be read, it can be sequenced in a machine. And the sequencing used for the 1,000 Genome Project is called Illumina sequencing because it uses a machine called an Illumina machine. And here they have lots of sequences, and they calibrate this. They have a software algorithm again for comparing the human sequences with the bacterial sequences, and they calibrate it using HeLa cells. The HeLa genome has been sequenced, and we know that integrated into the human genome, among other things, is human papillomavirus. And of course, everyone must know the story that HeLa cells were made from Henrietta Lacks in the 1950s, and Henrietta had a cervical tumor from which she died, but some cells were taken from the tumor, and those were the source of HeLa cells. And we now know that she had a papillomavirus DNA insertion into her tumor. So they could use their software algorithm to validate the presence of human papillomaviruses into her genome. And it's known that it's in chromosome 8, and they could see this by their sequence. So their programs work. So now they apply it to the human sequence. They have 3.15 billion Illumina read pairs. Now, in the Illumina sequencing, what you do is you take human DNA, you break it up into smaller pieces, and then you add linkers, which you then attach to a solid surface, and then you do the reactions. And there, you can do it in a couple of ways. You could read just one end of the DNA, or you could read both. And when you read both, it's called a paired read. So they have over 3 billion read pairs from this 1,000 genome projects. And of those, 3.15 billion, their software showed them that 7,191 showed evidence for bacterial integration. Okay, so just scanning all the reads for bacterial sequences in that Illumina database of over 3 billion reads, they find over 7,000 which have bacterial DNA in them.
Which makes it a very rare occurrence.
Yeah, I would think so, yeah. And the most common is our species of Brady rhizobium. And I think, Joe, you would like that, right?
Yeah, I found that to be one of the most curious aspects of the paper, because Brady rhizobium is in the same group of alpha proteobacteria as the Agrobacterium, which, of course, is the classic example, as you mentioned, of DNA transfer from bacteria to a eukaryotic host. Yeah. So I wondered if maybe there's something special about this group that they somehow know to attach well to human cells or plant cells or whoever their host might be.
Is this something you'd find in the gut microbiome?
I was wondering the same thing. I have not seen it myself, yeah. And I might not have been looking for it, because it's certainly not one of the things you would expect in the gut microbiome. Yeah. First of all, it's aerobic, and a good portion of the gut microbiome is anaerobic. And Brady rhizobia are really associated with environmental samples and plants. So it might be there. Maybe I just never noticed. But
Yeah,
it's
so they
an interesting find.
They note that it's unusual, but they note also that most of the samples that were positive for Brady rhizobium came from a Chinese population. These were samples sequenced by the Beijing Genomics Institute. So they suggest that it has something to do with diet. And maybe their diet contains these bacteria, and that's why this is there. And this is actually an interesting point they make, that when you sequence diverse human samples, you don't always know other things, diet, lifestyle, et cetera, that's associated with them. And those, of course, could influence the microbiome, right? So,
most assuredly does.
Yeah.
And it might introduce bacteria, but I think it's unlikely that Brady rhizobia or alpha proteobacteria like that would make it through the stomach acid. Maybe they would, but it's unlikely. But I think more likely is that the change in diet could select for growth of one group of bacteria.
Yeah, right. So they also found two other kinds of bacteria. Actually, they called them OTUs. Maybe, Joe, you could explain to our listeners what an OTU is.
OTUs are operational taxonomic units, which sounds very complicated, but it's really not. It's an operational definition of something that we can't define, and that is what a species is or what a genus is in bacteria. We really don't have good descriptions at that level. We don't know at what level of difference we cut off a species or a genus. And so for those organisms where we haven't been able to cultivate them and we don't know more about them than just a sequence, we assign them to OTUs, and to be equal, an OTU has to have some sort of number attached to it to say whether all the members are 100% identical or within 97%, which is typically considered equivalent to species, or some other level of similarity.
On the other hand, they give you the names of those two OTUs. Propionibacter acnes and Enterobacteriaceae.
I
don't know why they call them OTUs, but it's okay.
They shouldn't need to, except that some of their other sequences were unnamed. So perhaps they were just referring to all of the sequences as OTUs, and oh, by the way, one of them or two of them could be taken to real names.
Hmm. So one of them, Propionibacter acnes, they think that's a contaminant. It's on everyone's skin. And so they think that, you know, whoever is preparing the DNA samples contaminated the samples. Remember, these are just the presence of bacterial DNA sequences in the human sequences. So these are typically short runs or short reads, as they're called. So you would just get a bacterial sequence. So
But it does help in the sense that you do want to have some sort of a feeling for how often is contamination to be likely. You know, this tells you that it's likely.
Of course. They also think the Enterobacteriaceae is contamination with E. coli for the reasons we talked about before. So they actually throw out all hits of P. acnes and E. coli or Enterobacteriaceae, even though some of them might be valid. I mean, this is a very prevalent issue in this paper, and they have whole sections on contaminations, laboratory artifacts. Now, in fact, the next section they talk about trying to devise algorithms to see if the hits they're getting, that is the bacterial sequences and the human sequences, if they are artifacts or not. And so they use one way which puts all of the bacterial sequences into one of two classes. One where, so they look at the contribution of bacteria relative to the total population of bacteria, which is higher in reads, or one where it's higher in reads coming from the microbiome. So if you just look at the proportion of bacterial DNA, either with respect to the human genome or with respect to the microbiome, they feel that that can give them an idea of some, whether it's contamination or not, right?
So you're talking about specific bacteria.
Specific bacteria, right. So they have a very nice graph where they plot these two ratios, the proportion of these OTUs compared to human versus the microbiome. And the Brady rhizobium is much higher in this category A, which is relative to the human sequences. So in category B, which they would consider a contaminant, they have the Propionibacteriaceae, boy, and Enterobacteriaceae, category B. And another one there is Xanthomonadaceae, which they think is all contaminant. So Brady rhizobia, category A. And a big surprise, phage lambda falls into this A category, which they think is real.
Yeah, I can figure that out. Why would they think the E. coli is a contaminant, but the phage lambda is real?
Yeah, I mean, strictly based on this ratio, right? Because
it's a statistical argument.
Yeah, it's a statistical argument, sure. They don't know. And in fact, they end up saying that. They seem to think the lambda might be real, and that they think it should be validated. Mm-hmm. So that's curious anyway. Rate of integration, they can, from the numbers, they can look at how often you pick up bacterial DNA. So the trace archive data, which is the Sanger sequencing data, they had 680 integrations in 113 million reads. So that's 6 times 10 to the minus 6 integrations per generation. And the Illumina data, which are the 1,000 Genomes Project, it's similar, 2 times 10 to the minus 6 integrations per generation. And that's on a higher data set. It's 3 billion, if you remember, 7,000 out of 3 billion. So they think that that's a good sign that the rate of detecting bacterial DNA and human DNA is similar when you compare these two very different sequencing projects. Another issue that is really interesting is the coverage of the DNA sequence. And the coverage simply means, in its simplest way, how many times you sequence a given sequence or how many times you determine the sequence of a given region. So not really good coverage is 1x, which means you basically have one sequence run for every area of the genome, but 100x is really good. And it turns out that the 1,000 Genome Project isn't very good because it only has about 1x coverage. And having a lot of coverage would, in theory, allow you to see the integration sites of the bacterial DNA in the human genome, right? Because then you can assemble longer sequences from the short runs, and you can say, here's the beginning of the bacterial sequence, here's where it joins human DNA, and here at the other end. So that would clearly be better than simply having a piece of bacterial DNA in the human sequence. So if you look for in this 1,000 Genome Projects, for greater than 1x coverage is pretty rare. So now you only get 275 read pairs that are bacterial DNA. And again, that went down from just over 7,000. So that may be one way to limit contamination. And when you do that, the most predominant species level OTU is Stenotrophomonas maltophilia.
It's gone.
Which I had not heard of.
Well, that's a nasty pathogen.
Yeah.
You don't want to associate with that guy.
So they call it an emerging pathogen of the respiratory and blood systems of immunocompromised people.
Huh.
But interestingly, is another one that originates often on plants. So it really? Seems like plant-associated bacteria keep coming up here.
Interesting. Now, the curious thing here is that the bacterial reads, the sequences are distributed across the bacterial genome, but most of the reads, that's 100 read pairs, came from two people in a single study. So, it could be that one of these people had been infected and picked up the DNA, and that's kind of biasing the whole thing. But obviously, you need to do more of this. We don't have that many genomes. That's the problem so far.
Right.
So they say, given the low coverage, the data from the 1,000 Genomes Project is inconclusive in the absence of experimental validation. Can you imagine? So far, everything we've talked about, they feel is inconclusive. Now, remember, we don't have cell lines for most of this data. We just have blood, and that gets destroyed in the process of sequencing. And if you derive the sequence from cell culture, there's always the issue of contamination. And this is why they moved to the tumor cell genome archive. So this is another set of human sequences taken from human tumors of various sorts. And here we have over 7 trillion bases of a Illumina paired end sequence. So not just single sequence runs, but paired ends. And in this case, 691,000 read pairs were in support of bacterial integration. The cool thing about this database is that it has over 100x sequencing coverage. So you
100x?
Yeah.
Gone.
So you can start to get the integration sites. If you can assemble, consecutive reads, you can see, as I said before, the integration site of the bacterial DNA into human DNA. So an interesting number, 64% of these tumor samples. So in this database, this tumor database, they often have tissues from normal, non-tumor tissues from the same people from which they get sequence, and then they compare it to the tumor. So 64% of the DNA in this database is from tumors, but those DNAs had 99% of the bacterial reads. So there is a bias towards having bacterial DNA and tumor DNAs, just from that number alone. And a couple of interesting observations. The most common cancer that had bacterial, the most common integration or presence of bacteria, it was in acute myeloid leukemia, 665,000 read pairs, which had bacterial sequences. And in this case, in this tumor, Acinetobacter was the most common integrated or DNA present.
And another environmental.
Yeah. Followed by Moraxellaceae. Does that ring any bells?
Well, Moraxella is an eye pathogen, among other things.
Okay, so this
they
is
call a red eye, I think.
Is its natural reservoir soil or?
Gosh, I don't know.
I think Moraxella is more often an animal associate, but that would be worth knowing. Just because of the pattern that are found to be environmental.
One of the interesting observations within the Acinetobacter genome, the reads were often in the ribosomal RNA operon.
Yeah.
So not the most highly expressed bacterial genes, but rather ribosomal RNA seems to be integrated frequently. Also, the location of integration. Now, remember, because these are high reads, paired end reads of high coverage, you can start to see the integration sites. So
they make a point that ribosomal RNA is not recognized by the immune system as well as some other sequences that are commonly recognized. Yeah. I thought that was interesting. That was a good point.
Yeah, so it could be that RNA persists and therefore can...
That's right.
Yeah.
It's just not noticed and not hit.
Right. And in case anyone was wondering how RNA could get integrated, well, all of our cells have reverse transcriptase in us. We have encoded in our genomes various reverse transcriptases, so they could copy that RNA into DNA, and then it could integrate. So that's completely plausible and is thought to account for a variety of, for example, repeated elements in the genome. Location of integration, most frequently in the mitochondrial genome. Not in our nuclear genome, but mostly in mitochondrial genome in the cases where they can identify the integration. The next most common tumor that had bacterial DNA was stomach adenocarcinoma with 11,000 bacterial hits. And that was followed by breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And here in the stomach cancer, the most common bacteria OTU was Pseudomonas, and in particular Pseudomonas fluorescens. And there they could see the ribosomal RNA of 184 ribosomes, which is 98% of all the reads going from Pseudomonas ribosomal RNA.
And again, it's curious. That's a thought to be an environmental microbe, not something that colonizes humans all that frequently.
Very common on plant roots.
Right.
So, once again, plant-associated bacteria show up. It's very curious.
They make a point of saying that they only found two Helicobacter reads, even though Helicobacter is associated with stomach cancer. Doesn't seem to be integrating in the human genome. Now, finally, what genes are the bacterial sequences integrated into? Five nuclear genes have the highest integration rates, and these are all genes that are known to be upregulated in stomach cancers. They involve a lot of what are called CEA, carcinoembryonic antigens, and a lot of proteins that are involved in adhesion.
Did you think that this was a particularly cogent argument for this not being an artifact? The specific integration into the genes that...
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's quite amazing.
You would expect it to be random, right?
If it were, absolutely, yeah.
If it were a laboratory artifact, for sure.
Right.
And, you know, so they're very cautious in the end. They are saying, look, here's one of their conclusions. Based on our analysis, it is impossible to determine if lateral gene transfers have a causal role in cancer or are simply a byproduct of carcinogenesis. I think that's probably appropriate caution, right?
I think it is, because it could be either way. You could argue that integration causes cancer, or cancer just carries integration along.
Right.
Or the event that triggered the tumorigenesis, let's say some DNA damage that caused a lot of double-strand breaks, would then create an opportunity for non-homologous DNA to be integrated through non-homologous and joining pathway. So it could be the two events were coincident and not causal.
Right. One of the things they point out is that for many of these tumor samples, they don't have a normal tissue control. So they have some, but not all. You would like to have a normal sample from the same person. They don't have it. And they said they tried to do it, but they were forbidden to do that because of IRB rules. So, you know, there are a lot of questions that you can't answer because these are patient samples and they're coded, and you can't pursue it without your own protocol. They spend much of the discussion talking about possible contamination, they're very worried about that, but they do feel that there's some good evidence that there is some specific integration, and they say it's worth these data show that it's worth pursuing this issue, whether the integration of bacterial DNA is oncogenic or not. I don't know. What do you think would have to be done next to really address this? I guess you'd have to get people with tumors. You'd have to enroll people with tumors and get normal and tumor tissue and do this sequencing from them at high coverage, right?
And I think if you did it over time and found the same sequences in the same place, it would be really compelling, because I think it's the reproducibility that is the most powerful in the current paper and would also enhance any future analysis.
Right.
I still find it very puzzling that most of the species they identified are not bacteria that we know of to be in high numbers in the human microbiome, which would have been my assumption going in.
Well, maybe we have to ingest naked DNA. Maybe their DNA is in our food and they get in somehow that way.
Right.
I mean, maybe also a part of a study would be to sequence the microbiome of